there's a lot of evidence that they should no longer be on the force as well. I think that the university president should have fired them also, as well as the prosecutor charging them with this blatant lie. It's clear, even though all three officers knew that Officer Tasing had a body camera on, they still chose to lie. And that is very problematic for people who are trying to reform police departments and build stronger community relations with police, in particular the University of Cincinnati's police department.
Now, it is very rare for a police officer to be charged for a murder. You heard the cheer break out in the courtroom. Can you talk about the significance, and we just have 10 seconds, of the DA's very strong response, the immediate indictment for murder, not to mention the mayor backing him up?
Well, one, the mayor had the same problem in 2001 when he was chair of law and public safety, and that's when the eruption spilled into the streets of Cincinnati, Ohio, part of his language. Two, African Americans in the city of Cincinnati have had a terrible relationship with the prosecutor, Joe Dieters. So we are waiting for a conviction. We're not in celebratory mode. Officer Tasing has bonded himself out. The family is very worried about that, and so is the community. So we're waiting on a conviction.
Iris Rolle, we hope to speak to you again next week. Longtime police accountability activist with the Cincinnati Black United Front. That does it for our broadcast. A fond farewell to our cameraman, Jose Miranda. All the best to you, Jose. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks so much.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
I'm a loving the old lion, a winner without fail.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the PDX Leo Party, Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian. A birthday celebration for all you Portland Leos with special performances from Sleep of Old Dominion and the Chicharrones, Mike Crenshaw, Smoke M2OD6, and many more. Again, that's the PDX Leo Party on Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian, located at 426 Southwest Washington Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor, along with North Portland Community Building Group, Proper, of the We Can Do It Together community concert. Local politicians, community activists, faith groups, and artists will join in a day of unity, song, and prayer in Kenton Park on Saturday, August 8th, from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. This concert will feature a variety of local artists that will rally for unity in this time of unrest. Again, that's the We Can Do It Together community concert, Saturday, August 8th from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Kenton Park at North Kilpatrick and Delaware in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lent's International Farmers Market, a program of Zinger Farm, every Sunday at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Lent's Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market Club for kids, a community produce booth open to home gardeners, cooking demos, and live music. More at lentsfarmersmarket.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the police and Coast Guard have broken up the nearly three-day-long protest of the Shell Oil Company's Arctic drilling on the Willamette.
Israeli extremists killed an 18-month-old Palestinian child in the West Bank today.
And two Cincinnati police officers have been connected to the killing of a mentally ill black man in 2011.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, July 31st, 2015. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. The nearly three-day-long protest and blockade against Shell Oil in the lower Willamette River ended last night when the Coast Guard escorted the Fenica icebreaker through the blockade and down the Columbia River toward the Pacific Ocean. Three of the Greenpeace activists who were suspended by ropes from the St. John's Bridge were lowered to police boats and detained, and 11 kayakers were arrested. The Multnomah County Sheriff boat was filmed engaging in dangerous maneuvers like running over kayakers. A Rising Tide activist who locked his neck to a railroad bridge in a last-ditch effort to stop the ship from passing was arrested, and he was arraigned this afternoon. KABU was at the arraignment and spoke with him after he left court.
Well, the thing is that it's really important for people of good conscience to take direct action to stop the extraction of fossil fuels that is kind of violating our government's burden of protecting the public trust, but protecting the climate, because it is something that we have to protect for future generations. And currently, our government permitting things like Arctic drilling is actually illegal in this sort of public trust doctrine. So it's really important that people kind of stand up and use the necessity of protecting this resource when our government is failing to do it. Everyone has to take some risks to make sure that we're stopping catastrophic climate change. Right now, we're looking at we're in the middle of our sixth planetary extinction, and if we don't stop catastrophic climate change, we won't have human life on this planet. And that may be something I see within my generation. I thought it was really amazing. We really elevated, here in Little Portland, Oregon, we were able to elevate the dialogue around climate action from kind of being this like big national issue, like Charlie Hales is saying, oh, it's out of my hands. But really, we have shown that we can take local action to directly affect the fossil fuel industries and the other corporations that kind of have been hijacking our democracy, and we can directly stop them in their tracks.
He was charged with...
Could you tell us about what happened?
Jonah, who just spoke, was charged with criminal trespass and faces possible jail time. The kayaktivists arrested in the water received citations that said they could be fined up to $10,000. Now it seems that only one of the 11 kayaktivists that were arrested will face charges. KABU's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Austin Davidson, one of the kayaktivists who was arrested.
Could you tell us about what happened when you were out in the water yesterday engaging in civil disobedience to stop the Arctic drilling?
The Coast Guard picked us up out of the water. There were 11 of us, and we were trying to get right in front of the Seneca icebreaker, and the Coast Guard came up and hooked our boats and grabbed us out of our kayaks. Some folks were out of their kayaks and just in the water when they got picked up, and then we were all handcuffed and put in a Coast Guard and Sheriff's boat and taken to a Coast Guard station where we were detained.
And what were you charged with?
We were not charged. We were detained, and we received a ticket basically that says a notice of violation for unauthorized entry of a safety zone.
Did you go onto the water prepared to be arrested for civil disobedience?
I wouldn't say I was prepared when I got on the water. I got on at 10 a.m., but I feel like it shifted while I was out there. I don't necessarily consider myself an activist. I haven't been to many actions, but I think anyone who happens to be in the right place at the right time and is able to get involved in something when there's a right and wrong, just get in there and do it.
Well, thank you very much. Again, we've been speaking with Austin Davidson, one of the kayaktivists that were in the water yesterday. 11 were arrested, and Austin was among them. This is Jenka Soderberg with KABU News.
The groups who organized the protest said they were proud to have stopped the ship for over 40 hours, but they had hoped to indefinitely stop it from heading north to begin Shell's exploratory drilling in the Arctic. They'll hold a rally this evening at 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park to show support for the activists who risked their lives to block the ship and to plan next steps to try to stop oil companies like Shell from drilling in the Arctic.
Oregon state officials are planning how the state will comply with the EPA's new Clean Power Plan. KBOO's Ryan Stroyer spoke with Charlie Fisher, a clean energy advocate with Environment Oregon.
The Clean Power Plan, which is expected to be finalized as early as this coming Monday, is really the first and largest step we've ever taken as a nation to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Specifically, this reduces carbon emissions from power plants, which are the single largest source of carbon emissions in our country. Power plants account for about 40% of the nation's total carbon output.
Wow.
And just to put that in perspective, that is more than the total output of every single nation except for China and the United States. So if you add up the entire economy of Russia or Japan or India, our power plants alone emit more carbon than those entire countries do.
That's pretty outstanding. So can you tell me how the Clean Power Plan is going to affect carbon emissions? Like, what kind of rules are we expecting to come into play?
Yeah, well, so at the national level, power plants are going to have to reduce their emissions 30% by 2030. Now, the final rule hasn't come out yet, so we don't know exactly what each state is going to be required to do. But, you know, in a nutshell, what it's going to mean is more renewable energy like wind and solar and energy efficiency, and less fossil fuel energy like coal and oil and gas.
And what will the consequences be if states or power companies fail to live up to that standard?
Well, again, the rule is not final, so I can't give all of the details, but
sure.
It's an EPA rule, so the consequences would be just the same as if a power plant exceeded any other clean air or clean water standard, so fine, then other consequences.
You've said in this interview, and you say in the press release, that it's the biggest step the country's taken to tackle climate change. Do you expect pushback from fossil fuel companies and the fossil fuel industry? And if so, what do you expect and how do you plan to deal with it?
Oh, yeah. Well, there has already been quite a lot of pushback in the courts, in state houses, and in the Senate. The Supreme Court has already ruled several times that the Clean Power Plan is constitutional, and all of those lawsuits were prompted by the fossil fuel industry. And we certainly expect that utility companies and fossil fuel companies and politicians who carry their water are going to attempt to block this plan, but we're confident that the public is with us. In Oregon, over 70% of people support action on climate change. So we think the public is behind us, and we think that we can win on this.
So what does this have to do with the recent Supreme Court ruling?
So nothing related to the most recent Supreme Court ruling in terms of mercury and other heavy metal pollution from power plants. It's a completely different Supreme Court decision, but there have been a series of decisions over the past couple of years that have validated the EPA's ability to regulate carbon emissions under the Clean Air Act.
Could you tell me a little bit about the teleconference that's coming up?
Yeah, of course. So Environment Oregon, we're lucky to be joined by Congressman Earl Blumenauer, Angus Duncan, the chair of the Oregon Global Warming Commission, by Rachel Shimshack, who's the executive director of Renewable Northwest, and by Catherine Mader, who's the CEO of Mader Engineering, which is a long-established forest products engineering and consulting firm. So on Monday, assuming that that's when the rule comes out, all of us will be on the phone to discuss the implications for this in Oregon and next steps in terms of actually implementing the plan.
And what do you predict those next steps will include?
Well, that's a great question. And we know that states, after the rule is finalized, are going to have to come up with a plan to actually implement the rule, at which point our state leaders will have to decide the right way to get to hit those targets. And we think the best way to do that is by incentivizing renewables like wind, solar, and energy efficiency. But I would add that while we know this is an amazing first step, it has to be only the first step among many, because if we want to actually get to where we need to be in terms of where scientists say carbon reductions have to be, we're going to have to do a lot more, and there's no better place to lead than in Oregon.
That was Charlie Fisher. He's a clean energy advocate at Environment Oregon. For more information, you can visit www.environmentoregon.org. For KBOO News in Portland, I'm Ryan Stroyer.
Though it's early in brush fire season, dry conditions in Washington, Oregon, and California have already helped create more blazes this year than in all of 2014. Record high temperatures and low rainfall throughout the area have experts bracing for the worst. Washington State's Olympic Rainforest, usually one of the wettest places on Earth but now suffering drought, is the scene of a wildfire that's been burning for weeks. California, from San Diego to the Oregon border, is dealing with 18 brush fires. They only need a little wind to allow them to burn at an explosive rate, says a spokesman for the California Department of Fire and Forestry Protection. The National Weather Service has issued a red flag alert for Oregon's Klamath, Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas counties, and Siskiyou County in California. A warning reserved for dry, windy, and stormy conditions that can lead to explosive fire growth following lightning strikes.
Colorado's governor has issued a letter to federal officials urging them to approve a nearly 700-mile natural gas pipeline from Wyoming to the Oregon coast. The approval of the Ruby Pipeline would allow for a proposed pipeline from Colorado to Wyoming to feed into it, sending liquefied natural gas across three states to the coast of Oregon for export. The Ruby Pipeline, a proposed 680-mile, 42-inch pipeline, would extend from Wyoming to Oregon to supply fracked natural gas from the Rocky Mountain Basin. It is a part of the Jordan Cove Energy Project, which would create a massive port for natural gas export in Coos Bay, Oregon, owned and operated by Kinder Morgan. The pipeline would be the only national liquefied natural gas link between Colorado and the Pacific Northwest, ending in the so-called Pacific Connector in Coos Bay, bringing frack gas from the Rocky Mountains in Canada to the heart of Cascadia to be exported to foreign nations. Critics of the pipeline say the construction of this pipeline would threaten jobs in fishing, agriculture, timber, and tourism in Oregon. It would also connect the state to the fracking industry, which involves the use of explosives and chemicals deep underground to extract natural gas. The pipeline construction would require clear cuts of pristine forests and would impact hundreds of salmon streams. Opposition to the pipeline includes numerous groups throughout Oregon, those made up of anglers, farmers, ranchers, landowners, small business owners, and environmentalists. Oregon Governor Kate Brown has yet to publicly take a position on the issue. A final decision on the Ruby Pipeline will be announced by December 29th of 2015.
A Louisiana man is taking a one-man stand against a massive petrochemical company trying to build a chemical plant on its land. The company, South African-based Sasol Corporation, has already bought the land of all of Stacy Ryan's neighbors. But Ryan has refused to sell. He remains on a small property while construction begins on all four sides. Stacy Ryan wants to stay on his land, an eighth of an acre where he grew up in Mossville, Louisiana. Mossville is an historically African-American community founded by an ex-slave in 1790. It was one of the first settlements of free blacks in the South. Industry has been gradually eating away at Mossville for the last 50 years. Now 14 industrial plants surround what remains of the community, making it potentially one of the most polluted locales in one of the most polluted regions of the country. Many residents sold out 15 years ago when Condea Vista Chemical Company began buying up land in the community. But in the 1990s, Mossville citizens discovered that Condea Vista, which had been purchased by Sasol, had been transporting toxic chemicals through old leaky pipes. A class action suit was brought against the company in 1998, alleging that it allowed known carcinogens to seep into the town's soil, prompting a buyout of more than 200 homeowners. The company has offered Ryan $40,000 for his home and land, and he has continually refused. Ryan, a descendant of Mossville's founder, ex-slave Jacob Moss, has had his house vandalized, shot at, robbed, and as well contaminated by vandals. But he has pledged to remain on his family's ancestral land, no matter what the chemical company tries to do to him.
The Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability will, at the direction of the City Council, push a program to disassemble structures slated for demolition, salvaging materials for reuse rather than dumping them in landfill sites. Mayor Charlie Hale cites this process, formerly known as deconstruction, as one more way to address the recent increase in neighborhood demolition rates. It's considered a better alternative to demolition when restoring or relocating a building is not feasible. Benefits of the deconstruction include repurposing recovered materials, prolonging the life of landfills, preserving historic features and materials, and decreasing exposure to hazardous materials. Materials salvaged can be incorporated into a replacement building or sold or donated on a tax-deductible basis to material salvage companies.
Earlier this year, a one-night homeless census was taken in both Portland and Seattle to get an idea of the winter homeless population. Today, the final numbers of those one-night homeless counts have been released. The snapshot that was taken on January 23, 2015, found that in Multnomah and in King County, no less than 10,000 were counted as homeless in Seattle, and 3,000-plus people in Portland were counted. Of these numbers in Seattle, over 3,000 were sleeping on the street, over 3,000 sleeping in shelters, and almost 3,000 in transitional housing. Of the numbers in Portland, over 1,800 were on the streets, 800 were in shelters, and 1,000 were in transitional housing.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with... after this newscast for Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is hot and sunny with temperatures from 90 to 98 degrees. This will persist through the weekend. The National Weather Service has issued an extreme heat advisory for the next several days, advising you to stay out of the heat and when you can, and try to reschedule outdoor strenuous activities to early mornings or late evenings. Today in history, in 1919, Primo Levi was born. He was an Italian chemist, remembered by many as the writer of the book Survival in Auschwitz. In 1964, NASA sent the Ranger 7, an unmanned lunar probe, to take pictures of the moon's surface to prepare for the moon landing. And in 1991, the Soviet Union and the United States signed the START Treaty, agreeing to reduce their stockpiles of nuclear weapons by more than 30%. The quote of the day is from a Russian writer, Nazdid Mandelstam. Silence is the real crime against humanity.
Two of the police officers involved in falsifying the account of the police killing of Samuel DuBose earlier this month were involved in the killing of an unarmed, mentally ill black man 4 years ago. A report in The Guardian said the two men were among a group of seven University of Cincinnati officers who attacked a man who had been placed in a seclusion room after suffering a psychotic episode. The officers then shocked 45-year-old Kelly Brinson with a taser 3 times, and he died the following day. In court documents filed by Brinson's family in a civil suit against the campus police force, all 7 officers were accused of using excessive force. Among the 7 officers were Eric Weibel and Philip Kidd, the men who supported fellow officer Ray Tenzing in his false story about the killing of Samuel DuBose on July 19th. Brinson's family eventually settled a federal civil court case with the hospital and the police department for $638,000. all University of Cincinnati campus police officers were removed from patrolling the psychiatric wards at the hospital after his death.
Internet service providers and related industry associations filed briefs with the U.S. Court of Appeals Thursday. They claimed the Federal Communication Commission's reclassification of the Internet as a utility isn't legal. KABU reporter Robin Ryan discussed the latest legal step in the battle for net neutrality with media reform group Free Press.
I'm talking with Tim Carr. He is the Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
Internet service providers wasted no time in responding to the FCC's net neutrality rules earlier this year. They took action within 30 days, and that was back in March. Yesterday, the first round of briefs in the case got filed with the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. My first question wants to be, are there other courts with jurisdiction? Why this court?
There were a number of filings made by representatives of the phone and cable industry, and oftentimes they'll file in the home jurisdiction of their corporate headquarters, and then it becomes up to the courts to decide which court to hear this in. So that's a decision that's made by the courts. There were 10 cases filed against the FCC in response to their open internet rules, cases that were filed by industry trade groups, by internet service providers and the like, and the court had to decide how to consolidate all those filings and hear it at one court. So they've done that now, and we just received the first round of filings from these various petitioners.
And what would you say is the meat of the matter with regard to those 156 pages of documents?
Well, it kind of reminds me of that 1980s ad, is where's the beef? Because when you look at the FCC ruling that was made on February 26, you find that it was made on a very sound legal foundation, rooted in Title II of the Communications Act, which is a law that was passed with bipartisan support in Congress. And so they are putting forth arguments that somehow claim that the FCC wasn't properly following the law when it decided that it did indeed have the authority to ensure that internet service providers don't block or in any way throttle internet traffic. And they're making all sorts of claims now that they didn't, but we've looked at the law and we find that a lot of their arguments are very weak. So we have a high degree of confidence that the FCC will win this case, that its open internet rules are actually grounded in very sound law that defends the rights of internet users, and that these briefs, these filings, the arguments that the lawyers are making are without merit.
During the effort by industry to block the new rules from going into effect, which failed, and the court ordered these trade associations to conjoin their cases and take legal action in a more collective manner, I'm just curious as to whether you think that helps or does that hurt the public interest in an open internet?
Well, the court has to make that decision. These industry groups they have limitless resources. They have armies of lawyers, and they'll stop at nothing to try to reverse the FCC's decision. I would obviously prefer that they would join with us and the millions and millions of people who have called for net neutrality protections and support the FCC ruling. But now that they've decided to challenge them in the courts, we at Free Press are prepared to defend the FCC decision. The best thing for internet users is for ISPs to follow the rules that the FCC had voted on in February and protect the open internet, to not block or discriminate against any content that crosses their networks, and to let internet users be the ultimate decision makers as to where they go and what services they use and what they do every time we go online.
I've been talking with Tim Carr, the Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press. For more information, you can visit their website at freepress.net. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KABU News.
A rarely employed element of Japan's legal system has resulted in an indictment of three former top officials of the Tokyo Electric Power Company, owner of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant that melted down following the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. The officials were charged with professional negligence that resulted in death and injury. A panel of lay citizens selected at random, not state prosecutors, as is usually the case, forced the indictment. Under this procedure, 11 unidentified, randomly chosen citizens formed a panel to undertake an inquest. In this case, it was to establish responsibility for the radiation leaks that have been that have continued for the last 4 years following the 2011 meltdown at the nuclear facility. The legal procedure was introduced into Japan's legal code as one of many reforms following World War II. It was introduced to curb bureaucratic overreach into citizens' rights.
Israeli extremists burned a Palestinian child to death in a West Bank home last night. For Palestine Today, Maj Bajali reports.
On Thursday night, a Palestinian 18-month-old baby was killed. His mother, father, and 4-year-old brother were injured when radical Israeli settlers attacked the family home in the village of Douma near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. According to witnesses, radical settlers arrived at the village, sprayed anti-Palestinian graffiti on walls, then firebombed the Dawabsha family home, causing a fire that killed the baby and left his family critically injured.
Among other things, the arsonists painted the phrase "price tag" at the site of the attack. Palestinian and Israeli officials alike have condemned the attack, and the Israeli government has labeled it a terrorist act.